right, the first two verses of the chapter, which I've got at the very top of the page, if there is any consolation in Christ, any comfort of love, any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and mercy, fulfill my joy, being like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. And then verse 3, let nothing be done through selfish ambition. The word nothing here is kind of interesting. It's only used about 69 times in the New Testament. And it means not even a vestige of it, no part whatsoever. So it's kind of interesting. It's just an emphasis. There shouldn't be any of this in the congregation. Now, faction or selfish ambition. Let's start with the positive. What is ambition?
Drive.
Drive, okay. Drive to succeed. Anybody else?
It's your want for something.
Okay. All right. Wanting to better ourselves. Setting a goal. Reaching the goal. Feeling good about ourselves. Self-esteem, I think, comes with ambition, especially when we see our ambitions realized. So, selfish ambition, though, is a little different. It comes when people are scheming and jockeying for positions. And you see this in the schools. Does every school have a bully? Every school have a jock? Every school have a person who thinks they're just a little better than everyone else because they're rich or they're good looking or something? And that's faction. In politics, faction is trying to use other people's weaknesses in order to strengthen your position. And the real key to faction is it's what's in it for me. Not the whole, but what's in it for me. So when we start looking at this, when we take something that we're good at, maybe you're the most intelligent person in the congregation, or you're the wealthiest person in the congregation, or you are the best at teaching Bible classes or making comments or having people over. And instead of looking at that ability as a way to serve, some people look at that ability as a way to get over other people. Now, we see a lot of this. You see this in the Catholic Church. There's a hierarchy there where people have more power, their robes are brighter, their names are more majestic, and they are just like the Pharisees. They make larger phylacteries, they want to be called by men rabbi, and they want to feel that they're a cut above. So God says in Jeremiah, let not the mighty man glory in his might, and let not the wealthy man glory in his riches, and let not the wise man glory in his wisdom. But what should we glory in? Remember how he ends it? Let the man glory in this, that he knows me. That's the way, that's what should give us glory. Now, let's look at this verse toward the bottom of the first page in James chapter 3. I just want to look at the highlighted portions, verses 14 and 15. If you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. So when somebody comes into a congregation and they want to be looked up to, they want to be the highest. And so what's the first thing you have to do in order to get to the highest? Don't you have to take down the people that are their highest right now? So you start electioneering, if you want to call it that. You start going from people to people, whispering and saying things and trying to get people to look to you instead of to them. And when that happens, as this verse plainly makes it, there's confusion in every evil deed. And there's always somebody like this at the workplace. There's always somebody like this on a team. There's always somebody like this in a school or even in a family sometimes. And it just creates confusion and havoc. Paul and then David.
Well, the apostles were kind of guilty of this. They were always trying to establish.
Yeah, you're getting ahead of me there, but yeah, that's right. They're a classic example of the faction in its infancy. They saw the kingdom of heaven as their opportunity to get to the top.
And if it could happen there, it could happen anywhere.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. David?
It happens a lot in the church. I've seen it in action. And it's a great tool for the devil to split the church, to cause faction in the church. So I think Paul spoke to it very well in 2 Corinthians, I think it was in chapter 1, the beginning, about the tools not being, well, this as far as the selfishness, the self-seeking should be used.
Yeah. And they are, I mean, you can identify them if you're a godly person, you can identify them, but how do you stop them sometimes?
Sometimes
they're way under the radar. You see what they're doing, you see where it's going to go, you hope the people will see through it, but sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. All right, let's go ahead and, at the bottom of the page, you just want to look at that definition for a minute. Self-seeking, rivalry, seeking to win followers. Let's go ahead and turn the page. And so, working. The root meaning of the word is kind of interesting in the way this evolved, but the root meaning of the word is a day worker or somebody working for one day at a time. Now, if you're working one day at a time, do you really have much care or concern for the employer? No, you just want to get your pay. And you don't really care if you do it wrong or if something happens as a result, because you're only going to be there for one day. And then it came to mean somebody who doesn't really care about the whole, they only care about themselves. And that's where the issue comes in. And the 2 Corinthians 12 also uses it. And we see the company it keeps there at the middle of page 2. Contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, backbitings, whisperings, conceits, and tumults. And these all go together. If somebody has jealousy, it's because there's some faction in their heart. They want, if your goal is to help other people and you don't really care, you want to stay in the background, are you going to feel jealous if somebody else, something good happens to them, or if they're better than you are at something? If you have the good of the whole, there's no such thing as jealousy. And if we have the mind of Christ, which is to come to this earth, was there anyone greater than him ever on the earth? Did he ever use that greatness to set forth himself as being something special? Not one time. And so you're not going to have. Jesus was never jealous. He was never backbiting or whispering or that next one, hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, dissensions, heresies, and the like. So this all stems from one thing. At some point, as I was growing up, or you were growing up, we discovered that we had a gift or an ability that made us a leader and other people followed. And once you become a leader, you get to make all the decisions and everybody looks up to you and people get used to that. And sometimes when they become a Christian, they can't leave it behind. They look down on other people as being inferior. And if you're inferior and your decisions can't be trusted, then what do I need to do? See, I need to step up. I need to be the guy to make the decisions, and so I'm going to do whatever is necessary to accomplish that. And as Paul pointed out, we see faction in infancy at the very, well, not quite at the bottom, about 4 inches from the bottom. What was it you disputed among yourselves on the road? Well, what was it? Who's going to be the greatest? Now, I like to take one step back and think about this. Why would Peter think he was going to be the greatest? Why did John think he was going to be the greatest? What did they have that made them think they were going to be the greatest?
Their relationship to Christ.
Well, their relationship to Christ. What did Jesus call Peter? Changed his name, right? To what?
A rock.
So obviously I'm going to be the greatest. But John was the disciple whom Jesus loved. But each one of them had something, intelligence, wealth, power, something that made them think they could be the greatest, and that the kingdom of heaven was giving them the opportunity to rise to the top. And so they were arguing about that. And what was Jesus' answer?
The least.
Yeah. The least is the greatest. And so what we have to do is we start seeing our abilities not as a reason to make us great, but as a reason to make other people great. And so we see it again at the bottom of the page, verse page 2. Grant us that we may sit one on your right hand and one on your left in your glory. Now, why would they think they could do that? And why would they want to do that? And see, that's where we get to the heart of the problem, that Jesus gives the answer, and that it's not mine to give. Because if you think about it, when Jesus is in his glory, who's going to be there in this kingdom when it's the glorified kingdom? Will Moses be there? Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, all the godly people in the Old Testament, John the Baptist, all the godly people, Paul, Peter, and you two want to be the left and the right hand? Is that a pretty high thing to aspire to? And Jesus says, it's not mine to give. The Father will make that decision. Now, when the ten heard it, why were they displeased? Why didn't they just shake their head and say, oh, these guys, you know, we hope that they can overcome this. Why did they get angry? I think it's because they didn't think of it first. I think that it's because they felt like they were being undermined. And so when you have this kind of an attitude, is anybody united? Do we have any kind of unity at all if everybody's jockeying for position and everybody's using their abilities to try to become great in that particular group? And so faction is a serious problem, because what it stems from is something very simple. We think the ability we have is ours. Is anything that makes us great really ours?
No.
If we're intelligent, if we're good looking, if we're wealthy, if we're popular, where'd that come from?
God.
You didn't make your body. You didn't give your body the gifts that you have. If you're really good at sports, if these people who are pro sports people, because they were just born with way more natural ability than most people, and why would they look down on everyone else? Why wouldn't they glorify God and say, thank you, Father, for giving this to me? Well, that's the issue, and that's the problem. We see it in the Pharisees. We just talked about this one. But in God's people, nobody wants to be father. Nobody wants to be rabbi. Nobody wants to wear those beautiful red or gold or silver robes with gold and jewels around them, because that's not what God wants from his people. He doesn't want this faction. He doesn't want this selfish ambition. He doesn't want people who look at the church as an opportunity to take control and have other people look up to them. And you will always see this when a situation arises where somebody's opinion is questioned and they get mad. Or somebody who thinks they're in a position of influence suddenly finds out that there's somebody else who has more influence than they do, and what happens? They get angry, they get bitter. Maybe they can hide it, maybe you'll never see it, but if you are in a business meeting and you find your temper starting to rise, take a good look and try to figure out, why is this happening? Why would I become frustrated over something like this? And so, as Paul puts out, I really like these two verses. They're a little bit above the middle of page 3. I don't seek yours, but you. For the children ought not to lay up for the parents, but the parents for the children. I will very gladly spend and be spent for your souls. And then even Jesus, he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, that through his poverty, you might become rich. So what he's doing is he's turning things around. He's turning things back to the way they were. If you are motivated by agape love, as Paul pointed out in 1 Corinthians chapter 12 with the illustration of the body, if one member is glorified, what do the rest of the members do? They rejoice. And if one member is hurting, what's the rest of the members do? They're hurting with them. In other words, there isn't any there isn't any faction, there isn't any desire to put ourselves first or have other people look to us or see. What did Jesus say in Matthew chapter 7 or chapter 6? If you fast to be seen of men, is there any reward? No, the only reward is what you get from men. If you pray to be seen from men, if you give alms to be seen of men, what does God say? There's no reward for that because your motivation was wrong. You were doing it out of selfish ambition. You're doing it to get something, to get people to look up to you more, or to get people to talk about you in a good way. And most really godly Christians, they don't even like people talking about them. They want to stay under the radar. They want to do the work of the Lord, but they don't really want any praise for it because they don't deserve it. I mean, if you're godly and you recognize God opened this door for me, God gave me these abilities, God gave me these opportunities, and what am I in the whole thing?
Nothing.
Yeah, 1 Corinthians 3. I planted, Apollos watered. God gave the increase. So he implants and he who waters is what?
Nothing.
Nothing. Okay, when we get that, then this faction will go away. Go ahead, Jack.
You know, we're talking about, and you mentioned at the beginning of the class, selfish ambition. I think the perfect example, well, not the perfect, I think as far as human goes, the best example we have is Moses. He had no desire to gain power. He had no desire to become a leader. And yet God used him, even though he was hesitant to take on the responsibility.
Right.
He still did it. And did it, you know, with all his heart and all his soul. I mean, he made mistakes. But I mean, we can look at that and see that he gave up power to become an agent for the truth. And there's just so much to learn from Moses how we should act.
Yeah, and to add on to that, when other people were prophesying, what did Joshua say? Remember when the Holy Spirit came down on those 12 men and other people were prophesying in the camp? Joshua said, "My Lord Moses, forbid them." And what did Moses say? "Are you jealous for me? I wish everyone in Israel was a prophet." So he wanted everybody to be lifted up. And then when Miriam and Aaron speak against him because of his wife, he wouldn't defend himself because he was the meekest man in all the earth. That is, he saw himself only as a servant of God. And whatever greatness there was, he wasn't interested in. And I think that's, again, characteristic. Isn't Paul the same way? Isn't Jesus the same way? They're not interested in the glory. They're interested in the service. And that's something we all need to look at. You know, why am I doing this? Am I doing this because I want a good reputation? Or am I doing this because this is something that needs to be done and I have an opportunity to do it? Now, along the same line is this word conceit or vainglory. And there's lots of words for pride in the original language. This one means you think you're great, but you've got nothing. You are deceived. You are looking at yourself. This is empty pride. It is cheap pride or vain pride. It is delusion. In other words, you think that this makes you great, but it doesn't. And so look at this verse in 1 Corinthians 4. This is a passage that's really caught my eye over the last couple of years, and I've really thought a lot about it. Nate, you want to read it for us, 1 Corinthians 4, 6 and 7?
That none of you may be puffed up on behalf of one against the other. For who makes you differ from another? And what do you have that you did not receive? Now, if you did indeed receive it, why do you boast as if you had not received it?
Okay, and that really says it all, doesn't it? When Israel was going to go into the promised land, God said, you be careful because you're going to be saying, my power has brought me this wealth. And you shall remember what? The Lord your God gave you the power to get wealth. So here we are in America, one of the richest nations on earth, and here we have these people who just think that they are really something because they've reached the billionaire mark, or they're beyond that, and they think that they're just a cut above everyone else. And they start, you know, we're seeing a lot of this in our country today. People who think they know better than we are, who behind the scenes are making these new rules. Jeannie was telling me the other day, I can't believe this, that they're now putting bugs in hot dogs, and Tyson is doing it. Remember all those people, Jeannie, you talked to me about yesterday? They're putting grasshoppers and larvae and all kinds of things in your food. And if you look, you'll see it there. Now, who came up with this crazy idea? You know where it came from. What's the UN saying right now about us meat eaters? We're causing global warming. We're going to destroy the planet. So we need to quit eating meat. So we should start eating bugs. And then these corporations are jumping on board without even telling us. I mean, wouldn't you like to know somebody's sticking grasshoppers and larvae and crickets and different things into your food? Virgil, you have your hand up.
Comment you just made about this brings back something that actually happened to me probably 70 years ago.
70? Well, that was a while back.
I used to sell frozen foods for Beatrice Food Company. Had a route in Great Falls. And I was told by one of the other route guys that if you want to enhance your route, like you go to, we had all kinds of corner stores that we didn't have the big Safeways, that kind of stuff. That you make sure that when you take and put your ice cream into the shelving there, you also sprinkle some nasty stuff on your competitors. Now, you think about that a minute. You know, did you actually harm the product or anything there like that? It's perception.
Right.
It is what it is. And I don't know. I honestly never done that.
Right.
I've mentioned to my mom about that, and she says, don't you ever start doing that stuff.
Yeah, you can't. If you got to crush somebody to get on top, you're already in big trouble. But the point is, what do we have that we didn't receive?
Nothing.
So these guys that are multimillionaires that are sitting on the top of the heap trying to figure out how the rest of the American people ought to live, is that vainglory? Are they any smarter than we are? No. And so, and this happens in the church too. This is one of the reasons why we get divisions. We've got people coming along thinking that they are so intelligent that they can make the gospel better. Now, can we make the gospel better? No. But they think we can. Let's bring this in. Let's change this. Let's take this out. If we want to be a big church, we can't be preaching this stuff that's in the Bible, because God made a mistake, right? God made a blunder. He should not have put those things in there. David, you have your hand up?
You brought it back to the point. Again, you know, a lot of this in the church, in denomination, they are now peddling something that they have watered down because people like it. Where the church has to remain pure, given the simple truth, like it or not.
Right. You know, it's interesting because Virgil's argument, there's so much evil in the world, Peter says, that the way of truth will be what? Evil spoken. All right. So we're water salvation people. We don't have instrumental music. We don't believe in music. We are legalists. And they're just sprinkling all this nasty stuff on the Church of Christ so people won't even look at it. And yet, if you look at the basic precepts of the church, which is let's just stay with the Bible, is that so bad?
But that's what I was saying in my devotional. Read your Bible.
Yeah.
Read it.
Yeah, I like that devotional, by the way. Thank
read
you.
It.
All right.
I have to tell you.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Okay, so we don't have anything we didn't receive. So let's be humble. Let's recognize something, that God gave us these gifts, but he didn't give us these gifts. Let's turn a page here Let's talk about lowliness of mind. This word, you know, I like to talk about how these words evolved. This word was never used except in a derisive way. These are people who are lowly. These are people who are worthless. Let me read you this one section here. It's right exactly in the center of the page. It's partway down in that definition. For the aristocratic culture of ancient Greece, the worth of a man was determined by his parentage. A noble mind and virtue were inherited and could not be acquired. This word expresses the lowest state of the man who lives in poor and petty conditions. Also, the base disposition that resulting because you were born to a low class. It's just the same thing as India. If you're born in a certain class, are you looked down upon by everybody? You may be smarter than everybody else, but will it matter? You may make money. You could do whatever you want. You can't get away from that. And that's what this word means. You are the lowest of the low. You are people who are despicable. And here's Paul saying, here's the Holy Spirit saying, you know something? This word is exactly what we want in Christianity. We want low people. We want people who are lowly. When Jesus came, he sat on a donkey. And it says it manifested his meekness and his lowliness. Did he get low enough to be crucified and spit on and mistreated? See, his lowliness, and Paul pointed this out, he became poor so that we could become rich. So this word, and you can see, I went on and on with it because I just found it fascinating. I spent a lot of hours yesterday just looking at these definitions, especially the word form. We'll talk about that next week. We're not even going to get to it this week. But the form of God. Jesus was dwelling in the form of God. And it's fascinating. It's the only place in the New Testament that word is... Well, excuse me, it's used one other place. But it's not really used. And yet all kinds of weird doctrines are created by it. All right, let's go ahead and turn to page 5. Here's why we need to be lowly. Got three verses here. I'll have different people read it. Diane, you want to read that one at the very top, for I say through the grace.
For I say through the grace given to me, to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith. Having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us, let us use them.
Okay, so did I get to pick my parents? Why should that define me? Why can't my individual works define me? It's a gift. It's nothing special. There's nothing special about any of these things. God gave each of us a gift. No one is special. No one is above. And instead of looking at our gifts as a way to go above people, we need to look at our gifts as a way to go beneath them. Because we want to be at the very bottom, lifting them up. Isn't that what Jesus said? If you want to be great in the kingdom of heaven, you're going to be what? Last of all and servant of all. You're going to be at the very bottom of the pile. That's where I want you to be. Because that's humility. That's true service. When we recognize that our abilities were given to us to help other people. They were not given to us to crush other people or to rise above other people or to put ourselves in a position of greatness above other people. So, then the next verse, Rob, you want to read that one? 1 Corinthians 7:7.
For I wish that all men were even as myself, but each one has his own gift from God, one in this manner and one in and another in that.
Okay, so Paul had absolute self-control in the sexual realm. He said, I wish everybody else had this gift. But not everyone does. They have different gifts. We all have a different gift. And that's why Paul says, I wish that all of you could remain unmarried, but some of you don't have this gift, and others have different gifts. Then the next verse we've already read. So let's look at this last verse here. Jack, you want to read that? 1 Peter 4:10-11.
As each one has received a gift, minister it to one another as good stewards in the manifold grace of God. If anyone ministers, let him do it as with the ability which God supplies, that in all things God may be glorified through Jesus Christ.
Okay, so what we're dealing with here is a very different mindset. As a matter of fact, will you learn this in American schools today? See, you're not going to learn this in our culture. Because our culture, even though we used to have this rugged individualism, we're really moving toward an aristocratic society. We're really moving toward, and I think some people want that. They want to have an upper class and a lower class. They don't want a middle class. And right now we're in the process of seeing that being uprooted. And I'm not sure why. I don't know why people can't just let people grow and become what they had the ability to become. But it's all changing. But in the Lord's church, we have gifts. And we become great when we use our gifts to serve other people. The greatest in the kingdom of heaven is last of all, slave of all. The Son of Man did not come to be served.
But to serve.
And give his life a ransom for many. That turns it all upside down. Here we have God in the flesh showing us what the image of God is. And the image of God is perfectly portrayed with that word that we just saw, lowliness of mind. That which the Greeks despised, that which the Greeks only used for slaves and people who were born to poor parents and people who were scum, they were down at the bottom. That's what this word was used for. Holy Spirit said, hey, this is the perfect word for me to use to describe what Christians need to try to become. And so he took that word, just like agape love, he took a word that had no meaning, and he gave it a meaning that you don't even find in the secular world. The secular world would not even understand it, just like they wouldn't today. So, so the lessons here in that box on the middle of page 5. Jesus is the Son of God, the teacher and the Lord. You know, I'm jumping ahead of myself here. Let's read the verse first. Let's see. Vance, you want to read John 13, 3 through 6, just a little above the middle.
3 through 6 or 12 through 17?
No, 3 through 6, then we'll get to 12 through 17.
Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God, rose from supper and laid aside his garments, took a towel and girded himself. After that, he poured water into the basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded.
Okay, now, in the Greek mind and in the Jewish mind, there was nothing that was really much more demeaning than washing somebody else's feet. And the rest of the disciples wouldn't do it. It's kind of interesting that the person who gave them the room supplied it with the towels, with the water, but he didn't supply a servant. And when the apostles came in, what was the last thing they were going to do?
Wash somebody's feet.
Wash each other's feet. So Jesus is looking at them, and he sees their feet are dirty, and he sees that none of them is going to do it. But John wants us to understand, he knows he's the Word who created the heavens and the earth. He knows that in, what, 6 weeks, he'll be at the right hand of God, exalted with all authority, King of kings, Lord of lords, ruling over all the nations. And yet, here he is, taking off his clothes, putting on a towel, and demeaning himself in the eyes of most people, demeaning himself by washing their feet. Now, when he came to Peter, what did Peter say?
Don't wash mine.
You can't wash my feet. It's too demeaning. I will not let you. And Peter says, if you don't let me, you're not my disciple. You can't be my disciple anymore. You've got to learn this lesson, Peter. You have to learn that the greater serves the lesser. And that's what I'm showing you here. Now, when he gets done, Becky, you want to read that next verse, John 13, 12 through 17?
So when he had washed their feet, taken his garments, and sat down again, he said to them, do you know what I have done to you? And you call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. If then, your Lord, if I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them.
Okay, so here's our applications. That 1 through 5 at the bottom there. Jesus is the Son of God. Does anyone have abilities greater than he does?
No.
So, number 2, he did a lowly task to prove that doing a lowly task does not lessen the one who doesn't. Number three, the example proves that we ought to do lowly tasks, regardless of how great we think we are. Number four, if we still think such things are beneath us, do we think we're greater than Jesus? And number five, first we learn these things, and then, if we know them, we're only blessed if we do them. So, in the Lord's church, we're never going to have to wash anybody's feet. But are there situations that arise where people get themselves into the most terrible circumstances and you're just looking at them thinking, how could you be so stupid? Whoops, I shouldn't use that word. How could you be so dumb? And it's beneath me to even help you. You've been in this situation so many times before. And yet, what do we have to do?
Help them.
We've got to go help them. Even though, in every way, they don't deserve that help. But and we would never have done something so foolish. And they ought to just sit in it because they brought this on themselves. But no. Did Jesus take that attitude? These people on earth, they brought this all on themselves. Why would I want to go down there and help them out? So there's situations that arise where the character or personality or something creates a feeling of this person doesn't deserve help. And then suddenly they need help. And what do we have to do? We've got to figure out a way. We've got to figure out a way to stop doing that. And that's why he tells us that instead of looking down on people, we have, toward the bottom of page 5, each counting other better than himself. Now, this particular word means that we're all doing it to one another. There's no one who's above this. You're doing it to me, I'm doing it to you, we're doing it to them, they're doing it to us. The whole church looks upon this, and the whole church is counting others better than himself. All right, let's turn to the 6th page. And let's make the point again. Isn't that why Jesus say, look, there's a bunch of verses there. Mark chapter 9:35. See, Jeannie, you want to read that? It's a long one.
If anyone desires to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all.
Okay, if you're last of all and servant of all, how are you looking at everybody else? Are they better than you? You have to look at them as being better than you. All right? The next verse. Karen, you want to read that one? Mark 10:43-45.
But whoever desires to become great among you shall be your servant. And whoever of you desires to be first shall be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve.
Okay. So, if I see you as better than myself, is it easy for me to serve you? And if I see myself as better than you, is it easy for me to serve you? See, and that's the difference. The apostles saw each other and they said, I'm better than you. And it was a reciprocal thing because they were all thinking the same thing. No, I'm better than you. No, I'm better than you. Oh, no, I'm better than both of you. Well, I'm better than all three of you. And it just kind of bubbled up. And Jesus said, not so is it going to be among you. So now we're going to flip it around. You're better than me. No, you're better than me. No, you're better. All three of you are better than I am, and I'm at the very bottom. Now, anybody here want to fight to be at the very bottom? But that's what he says. Each counting others better than himself. And this word better, it's not just a minor thing. Look at those definitions at the top of page 6. This is the word that Paul uses when he says the exceeding, surpassing glory. This is a big word. This is a word for exceptionally valuable. To surpass in value, the second definition. To be above, to be superior in rank and power. So how do I look at other people? They're better. They're superior. They're more important. Now, we can't do that with ability, because there's a lot of people in this room. Can I say, can they say to me, I have more ability than you, or you have less ability than me? No, some people have, they've spent the time and they've gained abilities.
But does that mean they're better? And then we come back to it. If anyone has received a gift, minister it among yourselves. Right? Serve with it. And don't think of yourself more highly than you ought to think. You are a servant of God. And as a servant of God, he has told you, he wants you to be at the bottom, looking at everyone else as a way, as service. Now, if we do that, we're never going to have division. We're never going to have gossip, or we're not going to have these problems that other churches are facing, because we have removed the root cause, which is a feeling of superiority. And it's so hard not to get that, especially when you are superior in every way. And you have to learn that that doesn't matter. You're more important than me. Maybe more important would be better than simply the word better. Rob, you had a point, comment?
Well, we see this in the world, in the workplace, in our neighborhoods, in our government. So what you're teaching here this morning, I appreciate it, is this flies in the face of what our culture is, what thinking is. So, you know, you go from a workplace that has this mentality into the church, you gotta realize it's not the same.
Yeah. Now, and that's and again, it is the same, because shouldn't we take the church mentality into the workplace instead of taking the workplace mentality into the church? However, if you do that in the workplace, just be ready to be persecuted. Just be ready for people to look down on you and look at you just like the Greeks did. If you're going to be lowly, then you're weak. It's like the word meekness in our culture today. If you're a meek man, what does everybody else think?
You're a weak man.
We just walk all over you. You won't take a stand. You don't have any courage. You don't have any strength. Well, guess what? The word meekness means is a result of strength. You don't have to do those things. Could Jesus have called down how many legions of angels and just wiped everybody out? But he was meek. Not because he had to be, but he wanted to be. So this is something that we can take into other realms. Paul?
Yeah, I think that where everything, this is kind of leads to, is us practicing good self-control. We can't always control thoughts, and we do have, you know, I have my own little delusions of grandeur about my
I like that. Yeah, we all have a little bit of delusion and grandeur, don't we, about ourselves?
Yeah, and so it's basically, you know, and it took me 46 years to learn that, you know, some things are just better left unsaid. Just shut up. You don't have to have the last word all the time. You don't have to be right all the time. And I know the people that I work with, they said some of them think I'm a little bit quacky because I told them I was a young earth apologist, and they just think that's crazy. Everybody's been raised on evolution, and you know, and so yeah, it's just, but at the same time, I am planting seeds. I said, you know, I'm planting seeds for hopefully that people will take some time to think about, and you know, you just never know who you're going to reach, but yeah. At the same time, you know, it all comes down to managing your own self-control.
Yeah, that's right. That is right. Okay, so we need to look at other people. I don't think, can you think of any command that's harder than this one? I mean, for me to look at myself as a servant of all people, that's going to take a lot of work. A lot of work. All right, we'll go ahead and stop there since we're out of time. And we'll pick up in verse 4 next week. And once again, we're probably not going to cover very many verses, but I think it's worth our time, because what we're doing is we're digging into things that we don't like to think about, but which we really need to think about, because this is probably the final step toward being the most mature Christian that you can ever be, is when you can look at others as better as yourself and don't look just at your own things, but also at the things of others. Okay, we'll stop there.